dimensions. The analog of that in the statistical mechanics is the relationship between the transfer matrix thing with in which we write e to the k sigma sigma prime as cosh k plus sigma sigma prime sinh k, in which we write this as a constant times e to a term in k tilde plus sigma sigma prime times a term in e to the minus k tilde. The relationship between that, the Hamiltonian thing with all of the scripts on it, in which we have h is k naught tilde plus k1 tilde times tau 1, and the w of sigma sigma prime. The w of sigma sigma prime way of doing things is the way of doing things in, say, one dimension. And this is the way of doing things in, say, zero dimensions. But in general, the transfer matrix point of view, which I think I will probably tell you a little bit about next time. I'll probably prepare myself to tell you a little more about it. The transfer matrix point of view is the analog of the Hamiltonian point of view in quantum field theory, whereas this business with the W's and the sums over all of the sigmas is the analog of the Lagrangian point of view. In fact, the logarithm of Z is the direct analog of the path integral of the exponential. Z is the direct analog of the path integral of the exponential of the action. But now I want to start out taking us from the point of view in which we're doing correlation lengths, in which we're talking about the presence of excitations. You'll recognize excitations as something you're seeing in your quantum field theory lectures as well. They're the basic particles. To go on to talk about renormalization, which is something that you are not yet seeing in your quantum field theory, I believe. Who is the proud owner of the stick? Stick, stick, stick. Thank you. Okay. So we write out the partition function as a sum like this. And we want to think about how you might be able to analyze the problem without doing the entire thing all at once. We would like to do it in stages. So you write down this partition function as a sum like that of e to the k sigma 1 sigma 2 plus k sigma 2 sigma 3 and so forth. So I'll draw a picture that goes with that. I'm going to do that on the blackboard. I'm going to do it on the blackboard. Thank you. Up comes the screen. I like to be able to use the black, whatever there was left on the blackboard for my lecture, but apparently I can't make quite a full use of this, so I won't. And instead, I will write down what we're doing for the renormalization stuff. So, as I was saying at the end of the last hour, we have a chain of stuff. We have a spin here, which we call sigma 1, one there, which we call sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma 4, and I should get tired of writing. And here we have E to the K, sigma 1, sigma 2, times E to the K, sigma 2, sigma 3, plus times dot, 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 dot. Now, I am just going to change the names of things to help us along. I will imagine that I was doing a somewhat different problem on a somewhat different lattice with a different lattice size. Here, the basic separation between the points in the lattice is A. I'm going to imagine that I'm going to do a problem on a lattice in which the separation is twice as big. To do that, I will give a name, mu 1, to the first sigma. I will give a name to the third sigma. I will call that mu 2. So the mu's are just like the sigmas, except that they appear at every other lattice site. Sigma 5 is mu 3, sigma 7 is mu 4, and so forth. And then I will produce, and I will produce a new way of thinking about the problem by writing that I'm going to sum over sigma 2. That is, I will sum over every second spin what I had before. K sigma 1, but we call that mu 1, times sigma 2. E to the K sigma 2 times sigma 3, which we're calling mu 2. That summation is easily done. And what comes out is something that looks like the following. It looks like a constant multiplying E to a new coupling times mu 1, mu 2. How do I know that that's true? Well, there are two cases in this summation, two cases and only two cases. Either mu 1 is equal to mu 2, and that gives us one answer, or mu 1 is different from mu 2, and that gives us another answer. There are two cases and only two cases here. Either mu 1 is equal to mu 2, or mu 1 is different from mu 2. And we get the two different answers for those two different cases. So, the constant times e to the k prime times mu 1, mu 2, I'm going to get rid of that constant after a bit, is going to be, well, let's say that mu 1 is equal to mu 2. Then there are two terms in this sum. When sigma 2 is equal to the mu 1, which is equal to mu 2, and we get e to the k times e to the k, and we get e to the 2k. Or mu 1 is different from mu 2, and we get 1. Those are the two possible terms in the summation. I'm sorry. If mu 1 is equal to mu 2, we get two terms of the summation. One, when the sigma 2 is equal to both of them, and that gives us e to the 2k. And when it is different from both of them, it gets e to the minus 2k if mu 1 equals mu 2. If mu 1 is different from mu 2, the result of the summation is 2. There are two terms in the summation, e to the k times e to the minus k, or e to the minus k times e to the plus k, and the result is 2. If mu 1 is different from mu 2. So, this new coupling, which will describe the problem on double the lattice size, you can obtain the value of the new coupling by taking the result from mu 1 equals mu 2 and dividing out the result from mu 1 equals minus mu 2. So you take the result from mu 1 equals mu 2, e to the k prime, divide out by the result for the different case, e to the minus k prime. The constant cancels out, and we get this on one side of the equation. On the other side of the equation, you get this divided by that, which is twice the hyperbolic cosine of k from here, and 2 from there. The net result is that the new coupling, e to the 2k prime, is equal to, the 2's cancel, is equal to the hyperbolic cosine of k. This then a, this then gives us the result for the new coupling that we get in the new problem. Everything about the new problem is the same as the old problem, except that the coupling is different and the lattice constant is different. Yes, please.
This is pretty clear than how you go to a larger lattice spacing, but how do you go to a smaller lattice spacing?
Why do I have to go to a smaller? Oh, okay.
Ideally, we would want this to be a reversible calculation, since so we can recover the same situation.
It is not reversible. That is, we have lost information.
Okay.
That is, we describe, imagine that each of these couplings was different from every other coupling. We then have, if there are n lattice sites in the original problem, there are n coupling values. Okay? In the new problem, there are n prime, which is n over 2 coupling values.
Right. I was just wondering if it was possible to recreate the problem. And not the exact state, obviously, because you have half as much information.
It cannot. Technical name, the common name for what it's doing here is renormalization group. However, in the world of mathematics, you would want to call this a semi-group, because in fact, it does not go both ways. You can get all of the k primes, if we have different couplings, as a function of the k's, but you cannot invert that function. Here we have all of the k's the same, so we have a simple function of k. This is a simple function, and we don't have to worry about such stuff. The fact of the matter is that you lose information as you do the renormalizations. You have to. Okay. So I've done the calculation in front of your very eyes. The reason I wanted to do it on the blackboard is that there's a simpler way of doing this calculation. And that is, I can write this as e to the k tilde plus e to the minus k tilde times sigma prime times a constant. That is, the k tilde was a way of describing these two different terms, the relative size of these two different terms. I had that on the blackboard, so you asked me a question about it the last time. I'm then going to put back on, I'm going to do this same calculation in terms of the k tildes. If I have the same calculation to do in terms of the k tildes, I would write constant squared times the sum over sigma 2 times e to the k tilde times sigma 1, which is mu 1, times sigma 2, which is called sigma 2, and then an e to the minus k tilde. I then have a term e to the k tilde plus sigma 2 times mu 2 e to the minus k tilde. I just rewrote what was on this blackboard on this blackboard using this different notation, this different way of describing the terms. And now I am, the summation can be done trivially. I get here constant squared, which I don't care about. I get four terms, e to the k tilde times e to the k tilde. That's e to the 2k tilde. I put a 2 out in front because I have two terms of the summation. And that takes care of one of these four terms. The term mu 1 times sigma 2 times e to the k tilde is 0. Why is it 0? Because it has one factor of sigma in it, and that sum over sigma is over sigma is plus or minus 1. So that cross term is 0. The other cross term is equally 0. Plus mu 1 sigma 2 mu 2. Plus the sigma 2 squared is 1. Mu 1, mu 2, times e to the minus 2k tilde. And because there are two terms in the summation, there's a 2 out there. In terms of the k tilde, the calculation is that we get out a k tilde prime, which is 2k tilde. What do I mean by that? The structure we started out with was e to the k tilde plus e to the minus k tilde sigma prime. The structure we ended up with was e to the 2k tilde plus mu prime times e to the minus 2k tilde. It's the same structure except for that factor of 2 and the constants multiplying, which we decided we weren't going to pay much attention to. So the renormalization is that the new value of k tilde is equal to twice the old value of k tilde. When you work out what that means by doing the solving the equation, which is that e to the minus 2k tilde is the hyperbolic tangent of k, you discover that this equation is as it must be the same as this equation, except that it's simpler looking. And in fact, in this structure, the renormalization is a very, very simple thing. So let's go on. This calculation is I'm going to listen to your question in a second. In fact, I'm going to want to listen to your questions. This calculation is the root of many, many, many things that happen in particle physics and condensed matter physics. If you understand it, you understand renormalization. So ask your questions.
I suppose that if you have different coupling constants for each pair of spin in this chain, the k tilde prime will be the sum of the two k tildes that step before.
Well, we can see it, can't we, from this calculation. K tilde 1, K tilde 2.
Yes, K
tilde 1. And then this is not 2 K tilde, this is the sum of K tilde 1 plus K tilde 2. So yes, it is what you assume is indeed true. Now, this is a particularly simple example. By using the K tildes, I, in effect, solve the problem by going into the right representation. I can often solve problems by doing things in the right representation. Here I made the problem trivial by doing things using the right variables. In other situations, I can't figure out what the right variables are until I've solved the problem. In fact, the one-dimensional Eisenberg model had been solved probably for 60 years before these particular right variables were invented. So, from 1930 to 1970, 40 years. So that the right variables are often not precisely exactly 100% obvious. This is a late addition. This is the problem had been solved for ages before we saw this way of solving it. In fact, this we is correct. David Nelson and I believe, invented this particular set of arguments independently. Look at this calculation. Ask your questions about it. Figure out what it means. It's in the notes slightly differently. This argument is in the notes. This argument is not in the notes. I'm going to take it from here. Yes, please.
So I just have two questions. One is, if you do this, instead of taking out every second lattice point, taking out every third, do you get a relation k tilde prime is 3 k tilde, or is there some other more complicated factor in there?
Well, can't we do it? So imagine that we wrote another factor here, and that we were summing over this new thing over there. If there was more blackboard, it would be easy for me to show you that, in fact, the general renormalization is that the lattice constant goes into n, n being some integer, let me call it m. A prime is equal to m times a, and the renormalization in k is messy, but in k tilde, it is m times k.
And that's why it's called the renormalization group, because that has a, or a semi-group structure there.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the word.
That's why you call this the renormalization semi-group or group, because it has that group structure.
Yes, it has the group structure. Of course, it's a trivial example of a group structure. But imagine now that I was doing a problem which involved, okay, I'm telling you then, I guess, what the renormalization group is, because, in fact, I will tell you. Imagine that I have a problem in statistical mechanics, which has a whole bunch of coupling constants. Imagine I had a problem on some kind of lattice, and I had nearest neighbor couplings. and next nearest neighbor couplings, and couplings among four spins, and couplings among eight spins, and all kinds of complicated stuff. And I had some way, which you can imagine, of defining new variables in which the new variables were on a lattice of different size from the old variables. And that way, okay, I'll show you the way. I have two slides. I'll show you how it's done. So imagine that I have a two-dimensional lattice, and the two-dimensional lattice looks more or less like that, with lots of dots. Imagine that I cut the lattice up into boxes, and inside of each box I put a new variable called mu, the new variable called plus or minus one. And that new variable had to do with the old variables. In fact, maybe the new variable was equal to the SIGN of the sum of the old variables in the box. That's one possibility. So it's a variable which is plus or minus one and depends on the old variable. The old problem started out with couplings k nearest neighbor, k next nearest neighbor, four spin coupling, four of these guys, eight spin coupling, all kinds of hideous stuff. The new problem had couplings called k prime, which were functions of the old couplings k. And by putting vector signs over everything, I could say that there's a vector of old couplings and the new couplings was some function of the old ones. I can't invert that function because this is a renormalization semigroup. I can't go backwards. But those of you who know about the group theory would know that if I did this twice, I would get a k double prime is r of k, and that this structure is known as a group structure, and that this structure has first a prime is some constant times a, and then a double prime is a constant, is that same transformation done twice, which gives us m squared, and this r of k is a group structure, and that group structure then gives us a way of analyzing the guts of this kind of problem. I claim that the one variable version of this was due to Nelson and myself. This version with a vector of k is due to Wilson and is in fact what the essence of what the renormalization group is. That's question one. We might want question two, or maybe we forgot about it by the time.
Oh, that was why it was called the renormalization group. So you've answered it already.
Great. Your question.
Yeah, I have two questions. The first one is, you are considering a case where you are neglecting a constant, but yet you are equating a k theta prime to be equal to 2 k theta.
Okay. Let me then go on and tell the story a little bit more. If I have this whole collection of constants, I'm going to put in one more constant, which I'm going to call k0. In fact, I did call it K0 in a slightly different context. That won't hurt me to tell you what the renormalization group is twice. So the original problem has this thing that I call the Hamiltonian, or minus beta h,
which is a functional of the sigmas. It has a nearest neighbor coupling, and the nearest neighbor coupling multiplies the sum over nearest neighbors of sigma r, sigma s. It has a next nearest neighbor coupling and multiplies a sum over next nearest neighbors of sigma r times sigma t, where r and t are next nearest neighbor things. It might have, for example, in addition, a four-spin coupling times sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3, sigma 4, plus all translations, where these are four spins sitting on a box like this, and then I have all translations of that. And logically, I should include, in addition, a term times k naught, called k naught, times the sum over all lattice sites of 1. This now gives me a complete description of the problem, a complete description of a translationally invariant problem involving spins. This general structure is called a Gibbs state and describes the most general structure we can set up for a statistical mechanics problem involving these spins. Now, along with all of this other renormalization stuff, I have a renormalization, a part of this vector of k's I carry along. Oh, I shouldn't erase all this. I carry along k naught, and there's a k naught prime, which is some function of k naught and of all of the other couplings. So some function of all of the other couplings. That's the only logical thing to do. And if I continue to calculate k naught prime, as I do renormalizations, I generate more and more of the structure of what will eventually appear in the free energy. Eventually, I'm going to come down to one lattice site, and I have nothing left to do. But that k naught will be the free energy that got generated for the whole problem. That is now a full description of what you do to make a realization of the renormalization group.
To the nearest neighbor interaction, the normalization, is it a correction to the nearest neighbor interaction? Because if the way you define the mu is like going further, interacting with maybe somebody who is not directly a neighbor, but is a neighbor.
One of Wilson's great additions to this study of this problem is the notion that if you did something like this, you would have a complete and full description of the problem. And if you went through a procedure like this, you would then have an exact and full way of calculating what was going on. But there is something else to be said. Something which was partially recognized before Wilson's work and has become very fully recognized after that. Very little about this whole structure matters. The behavior that we're looking for is behavior near a place where there's a phase transition. Near the place where there's a phase transition, in fact, only a few of these constants give essentially different behavior. Only a few of these are really different from one another, and the rest are just extra baggage that we carry along. So, in field theory, although nobody has told you about that yet, you just include a few interaction constants. You don't include all of the interactions taking the field to the 10th order. You include a field squared term, a d mu field squared term, and a field to the fourth term. And you, at that stage, you can quit because you have everything that's significant. Similarly here, a nearest neighbor interaction, a constant term to hold on to free energy stuff. That's enough. Everything else is extra baggage that you carry along to make a full theory, but it isn't important really for the behavior near the critical point. Other questions? Now, these guys are not shy people. They have asked deep and richly difficult questions. That's probably because they knew part of the answer beforehand. Maybe that's because they're so deep and richly intelligent people. I can't tell. Probably a little bit of both. There is in this, however, a simple-minded question like, how does it all work? The calculation I just did, either on this board or on this board, is a simple-minded calculation. You could carry it out in middle school if you knew what an exponential was. Maybe even if you didn't know what an exponential was. It's not a hard calculation, but you have to understand it. So you have to read it, look at it, ask questions about it, understand it. It should be understandable to you before you're done. Okay, let's see where I am. Okay. Maestro, may we have the lights? Thank you.
Oh.
You do the group theory. That is, there are a bunch of, okay, I'm about to tell you about something about more complicated cases. Sometimes you know and sometimes you don't know. Often, in order to solve the problem, you first have to solve the problem and then you figure out what the right variables are. That's the usual case. Sometimes you can figure it out from group theory. That's less usual, but not impossible. Long before Wilson did his work on the renormalization group, Gell-Mann and Lowe, Peterson and Stuckelberger, and maybe Bogle-Yubov and co-workers understood what the right variables were for a pretty good description of quantum electrodynamics. There were basically three things that you had to play with, a size of the coupling, a size of the wave function, and something else which I've forgotten. But they had the right variables before the problem got solved by good guesswork. Sometimes you can do that too. Okay. I'm going to take a brief pause and tell you about the subject of statistical mechanics. In statistical mechanics, we solve problems like the Ising model, that is, problems which have variables, and the variables are sum over different values, and this represents a sort of statistical problem. We do that on lattices, or sometimes off of lattices, in 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 dimensions, different triangular lattices and square lattices and cubic lattices and all kinds of hairy things. And we gain experience that enables us to say what the solution to a new problem will be when it comes up. I'm going to spend a moment here. After the intellectual fireworks, the renormalization I'm going to consider to be intellectual fireworks. After the fireworks, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the subject of statistical mechanics and what kinds of variables we play with. So the eigenvariable we played with here takes on two values, plus or minus one. There are problems in ferromagnetism involving spins. Well, spins can do lots of different things. Physical spins can have two possible directions, or can point in one of several directions, or can go around and point equally well in a plane, or can point in directions in three-dimensional space, or we can think about what they might do in four- and five-dimensional space. Each one of these different kinds of variables has been extensively studied, and each symmetry, the symmetry of two-dimensional space, the symmetry of three-dimensional space, has been studied both for the internal variables, the analog of the sigma, and for on the kind of lattice, or kind of space we do it in. We've thought of ferromagnetic couplings, that is, couplings in which spins try to line up along with each other, and anti-ferromagnetic couplings in which they line up in opposite directions, and ferrimagnetic couplings in which they line up in somewhat cockeyed directions. There are phase transitions studied in all of those problems and the behavior away from phase transitions. There are what are called Potts models. A Potts model is a model in which a variable can take on any one of Q values. Each one of these variables is put on a lattice site. They can take Q values. And the question is, what the energy depends on whether the two guys at neighboring sites have the same value or different values. This is called the Potts model. I told you about S being a Q component vector and the interaction being the dot product of such two component vectors. Any blessed symmetry group you can think of, and many that you probably can't think of so easily, including SU2 and the group called the monster, and any group you can think of. It is called the monster. It's got lots of elements. Any group you can think of, it's known to its friends as E8, as I recall, but that's another name for it. Any problem you can think of, there's somebody working on the statistical mechanics of it. And something has been understood, or someone has hoped to understand it. There's a question back there.
A link between the Q in your second paragraph and the Q in
the,
your third paragraph?
No. The only link is the paucity of the alphabet. Let me see. Q-state Potts model. No. There's a Q-component vector. That is continuous symmetry with two different components. And then there's a Q-state Potts model. That is two different variables, two different values of the variables. They are both studied, both things are called Q conventionally, and they are different things. The world is rich and full of this, and full of other geometries. I haven't told you about the other geometries yet. So far, I told you about problems in which neighboring guys either line up or don't line up and have interactions between two guys who are neighbors of one another. That's going backwards, let's go forwards. Nope. Stop that. Okay. So let's get back into sync with the notes and see what we're doing. So I told you about the renormalization calculation. I told you about the calculation which gives new couplings. And in fact, I told you that there was going to be a constant term, like that term on this here. And and I told you what the renormalized thing was going to be. The renormalization calculation tells us something about the one-dimensional problem that we sort of already knew.
How could I? This one. Here is a line representing couplings. Coupling infinity goes up that way. Coupling zero is right here. This might be coupling value equal to 1k. I might have started out with this value of the coupling. After one iteration, I would have come up with a k prime, which is here. The natural thing to do after you do one step of renormalization is to do two steps of renormalization. This is another one of Wilson's additions to the subject, seeing that this was sort of the natural thing to do and to make a group out of it. However, it was also recognized in field theory before Wilson worked with the group properties and before. So you do one step from here to there, you go to there, and to there, to there, to there. Multiple steps of renormalization. And the key fact about this one-dimensional Ising model calculation is that the coupling continues to get weaker and weaker and weaker until after many, many steps of renormalization, you end up there at k equals zero. That is usually represented in not a very deep way by drawing this line and putting arrows on the line showing you how the couplings flow. And in fact, you didn't ask me the question, but I will answer it, that by doing interpolations between integer values of renormalizations, you can get a continuum of renormalizations. You can ask what happens if you multiply the coupling constant by a value of pi, or 1.3, or 2. Well, 2 is easy, we just did it. But pi or 1.3 requires some interpolation, but it's easy to do. So you look at such renormalizations, and you say the coupling constants flow, and they flow towards a trivial behavior at zero coupling, in which the system behaves like a weakly coupled system. In fact, the system behaves like a weakly coupled system pretty much for any value of the coupling, because as you do the renormalizations, as you look at it with a grosser and grosser scale, you see that the correlations die away and that you see the thing behave like a system with zero couplings. Okay. I said that sloppily. Here is the notes it said with care. The renormalization calculation tells us what we already know, that the one-dimensional model has no phase transition. A phase transition is a change in the long-range structure of correlations in the system. Here, the couplings gradually weaken as you renormalize to longer and longer distances. This gradual weakening of the couplings is not a change at all. In the long-range structure. The long-range structure ends up here at zero coupling and is trivial. The system is always behaving like this zero coupling thing, and so there's no phase transitions. The description is that after many iterations, the system approaches the coupling zero. I'll show you a non-trivial case in a moment. Time flies. I'll show you a non-trivial case in a moment. We're going to play with a two-dimensional Ising model. I'm not going to be able to do an exact renormalization calculation for the two-dimensional Ising model. Although we have an exact solution of the two-dimensional Ising model due to Ansager, this involves a hairy transition, a hairy transformation into other variables which are not in any simple way related to the spin variables we start out in the two-dimensional Ising model. However, I can just qualitatively describe to you what happens in a renormalization calculation for the two-dimensional Ising model
And this is what I'm going to do, starting now and continuing tomorrow, Saturday. Questions or comments? You may have developed some, and we're starting a new topic. Yes, please.
An idea of the link between renormalization in statistical physics with this and renormalization in quantum field theory.
I'm tempted to say yes, of course they're identical. I'm going to tell you something slightly different to you. In low dimensional problems, you're best off working here in coordinate space, that is in R's. In the quantum field theory, the same thing is done, however it is done always, often, but not always, in a different manner. It is done in momentum space, which provides a more natural description of the problem. What you do, I'm trying to figure out whether I should do it on the blackboard or not. What you do in quantum field theory is, as you know, problems in quantum field theory involve momentum variables, which go essentially from magnitude zero through magnitude mass of the particles to magnitude infinity. What you do in doing a renormalization calculation in quantum field theory is gradually eliminate the values of the momentum, which are the highest possible values. That is, you eliminate momenta, the momentum shells close to infinity, little by little, one tiny shell at a time. And as you do that, the coupling constants, you haven't seen what a coupling constant is, but I'll tell you, this is a perfectly simple-minded concept. You have a coupling, for example, which is the mass of the particle. That's field squared, as you know. You tend to have a coupling in what is called five-fourth field theory, which is the field raised to the fourth power. And there's a coupling constant in front of that. And you might have in color quantum chromodynamics a coupling which involves something on a plaquette, which is a loop. As you change as you eliminate momentum shells, the values of the coupling constants change infinitesimally. They are said to run. That's the technical word for it. These running coupling constants then describe what happens as you change the problem little by little. Probably the biggest event in quantum chromodynamics, that is, the theory of strong couplings, was when Wilczek and Politzer and Gross, those three people, showed that the couplings got weaker and weaker as you eliminated higher momentum shells in quantum chromodynamics, theory of strong interactions. That showed that if you did calculations involving very high energies, you would you'd be able to do them with very weak couplings, and hence with what is called perturbation theory. So the technical means for doing renormalization calculations in quantum field theory are different from the technical means that are used in these low-dimensional problems. But the concept, the important part is not the technical means. Not the fact that I sum over some spin or another. The important thing is that I change the number of degrees of freedom, and that I see the couplings change as I change the number of degrees of freedom. And then there are a bunch of other concepts, which I will tell you about starting on Saturday, that you use to analyze this change in the strength of the couplings. Questions further? Okay. I'm going to get into this a little bit, but now I'm mostly going to describe for you the nature of the problem. The two-dimensional statistical mechanics problem, called the two-dimensional Ising model, was solved by Ansager. The exact problem solved by Ansager was one in which there's a coupling called K between spins which are nearest neighbors to one another, sit next to one another on this two-dimensional lattice. We're also interested in what happens when there is a magnetic field called H in the problem. The spins take on values plus or minus one. Here's a picture of what it means for something to be a nearest neighbor of an R in this two-dimensional lattice. These guys, S's, are the nearest neighbors to R. And you have couplings, bonds, e to the k, sigma, sigma prime for these guys. I'm going to start out by telling you today, what time did we start today? Anybody want to, anybody remember? We started at 40. Okay, so I have another 10 minutes. Okay, I will tell you a little bit about how one solves problems before one has an elegant theoretical method to give their qualitative solution. I'm going to tell you about series expansions. But this also will provide us with elegant information which we can use to get lots of the properties of the system. I'm just erasing something. I'll write down pretty much exactly the same thing again. Black is our lattice. Blue is the coupling constants we have. Each coupling constant is e to the k sigma, sigma prime, which is, we can write as the hyperbolic cosine of k, and then plus a factor in sigma, sigma prime. We've now written this in several different ways, but the hyperbolic tangent of k. Since the hyperbolic cosine times the hyperbolic tangent is the hyperbolic sine, this is the same thing as we've written before. Cosh plus sigma sigma prime times sinh. So now you might ask, what would you do if you were going to calculate the partition function in the most straightforward possible fashion? Well, you'd write down this and take each one of these bonds that you see here and write it like this. The first thing you get out is a product of hyperbolic cosines. In fact, a hyperbolic cosine raised to the number of sites in the lattice. You might also do a bunch of spins. In fact, this is a hyperbolic cosine raised to the size of the lattice squared times 2, since there are two such bonds for each site in the lattice. Then you get a 2 to the L squared, because you're summing over all of the L squared spins in the lattice. L is this distance. And then you'd get out a bunch of terms. First term you'd have is 1, and then you'd have one hyperbolic tangent and a pair of sigmas, and two hyperbolic tangents and a pair of sigmas, two hyperbolic tangents and four sigmas. And you would feel a little discouraged because this term gave 0 and this term gives 0. In order to get a non-zero term involving the hyperbolic tangents, you have to go up to a fourth order. You get a hyperbolic tangent from here times this spin times that spin,
a hyperbolic tangent from this guy times this spin times this spin, another hyperbolic tangent from this guy, and a fourth one from that guy. If you have a closed loop here, every spin appears twice, and if every spin appears twice, it is replaced by square of that, and the square of a spin is 1, and the square of the, and so you get a structure which looks like the hyperbolic tangent to the fourth power, and if I have 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, I get sigma 1, sigma 2, times sigma 2, sigma 3, times sigma 3, sigma 4, times sigma 4, sigma 1, and every guy appears twice, so it's just the hyperbolic tangent to the fourth. And I count the number of hyperbolic tangents to the fourth I can possibly get. There are L squared of those, and I write down L squared times hyperbolic tangent to the fourth. And then I draw the other pictures that I possibly can draw, all of the other pictures I possibly can draw. Every time I get a closed path like this one, or like this one, or in fact like the product of the two, which is also a closed, bunch of closed paths, I write down a term and claim that term is non-zero. Every time I have an open path, like maybe going from here to here to there, I can write down what I want, but it's not, but it's zero, so I leave it out. So I sum over all possible closed paths and write down an expression. Such stuff is hard work, and it's harder work because we're not interested in z, we're interested in taking the logarithm, and so you've got to take a logarithm of some hairy expansion, and that's, you learn how to take logarithms of expansions. And you end up getting an expression which is a power series expansion in the hyperbolic tangent of k to some power m for the logarithm of the partition function. If you can figure out how to extrapolate this to an infinite sum, you can figure out how the logarithm of the partition function behaves, and there are techniques for doing that. However, I want to put that aside. We take this calculation, we put it in our drawer, and then we can start doing another calculation, which is not entirely dissimilar. This, as you can see, is an expansion in high temperatures. It works at high temperatures. It says the hyperbolic tangent is small. I can also do an expansion in low temperatures, saying that e to the minus k is small, and figure out how that expansion works. I have 5 minutes, which is about the right amount of time, to tell you how an expansion like that works. And then, once we've done an expansion like that, and an expansion like this, we can figure out something about how the thing behaves. So a basic bond, once again, is e to the k sigma sigma prime. At low temperatures, each and every one of these spins wants to line up with the other guys. So that, let's say that they all have the value plus, or most of them have the value plus. So all of the dots on this picture represent plus spins, except for a few. Maybe this one right here has been turned over and is a minus spin. Then this bond here, and this bond here, and this bond there, and this bond there, all have the wrong value. I get an e to the minus k from here, and since it would have been e to the plus k, without having the wrong value of the spin, I get an e to the minus 2k from that. I get an e to the minus 2k from this, and e to the minus 2k from that. And all in all, I get 4 e to the minus 2k's, so I get e to the minus 8k from this. Then I can imagine that this whole collection of things inside of this
set of lines has been turned the wrong way. Then each one of these bonds is wrong, and this up here, which I'm too lazy to write, each one of those is wrong, and I have to count each one of those, and I have to count the number of e to the minus k's, or e to the minus 2k's, that go with this path, separating the region of spins that are the right way from the region of spins that are the wrong way. But maybe inside of this region, I have one that is the right way, and I have to then recount an e to the minus 2k for all of this stuff. So pretty soon, I have an expansion in e to the minus 2k based upon diagrams, pictures, that look like this. How do these pictures differ from these pictures? Well, one's red and the other's blue, and that's the major difference between them. These guys are all the closed curves I can draw between points on the lattice and represent the expansion in the hyperbolic tangent of k. These guys represent all the closed curves I can draw starting out at points halfway between lattice sites, so-called dual sites, and drawing closed curves of that. And they represent an expansion in e to the minus 2k. However, the expansions are identical, not one whit different. There is a fancy word that goes with this. This is a dual invariance. That is a invariance with between the low temperature theory and the high temperature theory. They are essentially the same theory, except the variables have been changed to reflect something or other. The variables are different, but the expansions are the same. Next time we pick up on this dual invariance and we use it to understand where the critical temperature of the two-dimensional Isaac model is and some other important symmetry properties of the two-dimensional Isaac model. However, I just have another minute to fill in, and I will fill in by saying that this sort of dual invariance is a combination of a topological property, that is, the topology of these paths is the same as the topology of these paths, a topological property of the spins of the Isaac model, that is, a symmetry that is connected with the flipping of a spin, and that this combination of a spatial topology and an internal topology is a very internal symmetry topology, is a very important kind of a combination in the physics of the 21st century. You, almost all of you, probably all of you, have heard about M theory and the various invariants, the various transformations which take you from M theory, which is supposed to be one version of the theory of everything, to all of the other versions of the theory of everything. Those transformations all are of the same underlying gut nature as they probably are. We don't understand them fully, but they're probably basically the same as the relationship between the red pictures and the blue pictures that I just showed you. A combination, well, they certainly are a combination of something that has to do with the symmetry of space and something that has to do with the internal symmetries of the variables that occur on that space and the deep behavior of the product of internal and space symmetries are, well, in that case, space-time symmetries, are what are the guts of what make for these important symmetries of nature. We see this in its simplest form in this dual symmetry, which I just explained to you, which you could read about in the notes. This is a symmetry originally analyzed by Kramers and Vanier. I will discuss the symmetry next time and tell you how the renormalization group works
for the two-dimensional Ising model. Questions? Yes, sir.
These analyses affect the case where lattices are not regular, where we have defects.
I believe the question is, how would this kind of stuff affect the situation in which the lattice was irregular?
Yeah.
My ears are not 100% my best feature, so I have to look at it a little bit. It also gives me an opportunity to stall and reflect on the question in my mind. There are phase transitions in irregular lattices. They are a deep, interesting subject, solved largely by people who work in computer sciences or around computer sciences. They probably lack these on the analog of these dual symmetries, or at least it is not known what they are. They are extremely rich and interesting problems. The problems that I'm talking about in phase transitions in condensed matter physics, and most of the problems that you learn about in quantum field theory, or in the other advanced subjects you'll be studying, are phase transitions that have to do with the uniformity of space, so sort of crossed into the richness of the internal symmetry group. If you have a non-uniformity of space crossed into some internal symmetry group, something different happens. And we know a little bit about that different thing, but we do not know of any analog of dual symmetries, I believe. Further questions? We've got deep questions here, but I emphasize to you once more that the algebra that goes into this renormalization calculation, particularly the one-dimensional renormalization calculation, is instructive algebra worth studying, worth understanding, because it is sort of the guts of what, at this algebra too, it's sort of the guts of what people would do in much more rich, complicated, and complicated problems. On to the next time, renormalization.